May it please the court, I'm Greg Gold, registration number 26064. I represent David Kisselman, also on behalf of Michael Barr and Nelson Boyle, who are counsel as well, Your Honors. What the issue precisely before this court on this specific issue that we have before us today is whether the new statute for the unreasonable delay or denial of insurance benefits that went into effect on August 5th, 2008, whether that applies to unreasonable delay and denial of insurance benefits after its effective date, August 5th, 2008. Before we got to this court today, Your Honor, yes, absolutely.
Because as I read the briefs, I see both sides saying, yes, of course, the statute applies prospectively. That's not an issue. Isn't the issue is whether it applies to a case like this where you have post-effective date acts alleged as being unreasonable where the claim was made prior to the effective date of the statute. Isn't that the specific issue in front of us?
His Honor is precisely right. As we review the briefs on both sides, the American Family concedes on page 30 that this act has prospective application. And then we concede it has prospective application, and we argued and wrestled at with the district court, but eventually withdrew the argument regarding retroactive application. So what we have here now before us is where an insurance company not only wrestles with the issue of whether they should review a claim, and or a plaintiff tries to bootstrap and say, we want you to review a claim. We have a situation where after August 5th, 2008, there is a life care plan submitted to the insurance company that is valued between 1.3 and 4.5 million. For Judge Kopelke eventually found it was the total value of the claim was $1.3 million, standing in comparison to a $28,500 additional offer from American Family. But what you have is you have instances where there is a deposition, there's the life care plan, there's an economic report, and then on the eve of an arbitration, after four requests from Mr. Kisselman, please review, evaluate my claim, there's an evaluation, and then there's a decision made, let's offer $250,000, and as the record indicates, to make this state court go away. And so what the plaintiff seeks to do is to have an opportunity to argue to the jury that it is an unreasonable delay from the time the statute goes into effect, which all parties seem to be in agreement with, from August 5th, 2008, until the time it was paid, which was in January of 2009. And the plaintiff submits we've provided evidence to at least consider, have this issue considered before the jury.
Let me ask you a practice.
Yes.
Offshoot of let's assume this goes back. So you still got your common law claim sitting out there. And as I understand, don't you? I mean,
well, you're on about that's briefed before the court.
I understand. Yes. And there's a summary judgment motion, yes, on all of this that's sitting there waiting if this comes back. But you've got your common law claim. If this goes to the jury, as I understand the law, on your common law claim, everything comes into evidence from day one all the way through trial that you're claiming is unreasonable behavior. But on your statutory claim, you only get the post-effective date acts in terms of what you can rely on. What's the trial judge supposed to do in terms of instructing the jury or making this clear in terms of how this all gets sorted out?
Yes, there's different standards for those two as well. What the trial court should, we would suggest the trial court should do is in our motion for reconsideration, and what actually occurred Vaccaro case, which Judge Enquist also did in that case, was to ask the jury, was there an unreasonable delay or denial after August 5th, 2008 for benefits. It's simply what Judge Mage did in our supplemental authority that we submitted. It says, if the jury finds that there's an unreasonable delay or denial after August 5th, 2008, then the statute applies. If the jury doesn't find there's an unreasonable delay or denial after August 5th, 2008, then the statute does not apply. Judge Mage joined a list of us, what is in the record, of at least six other district court judges, including Judge Lewis Babcock, Judge Christina Mix, Judge Wiley Daniel, Judge Shell Gilman in the Barnes case, says that the conduct apply if it's limited, if it's unreasonable after effective date, it applies. Judge Moore Stand said, and those are the judges who have decided this, have said a limiting instruction, which courts do on a regular basis with jury instructions, to be able to address, to give effect to this statute after August 5th, 2008. And so that is the simple issue that we, that Mr. Kistelman would like to be able to have available to him, as the Baracco case and the five or six other cases, to be able to avail himself of this statute that provides for remedial measures for the unreasonable delay or denial of insurance benefits. And the case started out as much more with regard to the retroactivity, but we're simply asking from August 5th, 2008, that the law that everyone seems to say exists apply to Mr. Kistelman as well, Your Honor.
What would the amount be, though, that you're asking the court to apply the statute to the 250, to the entire amount?
Yes. Yeah, it would, the amount that we, the way the statute reads is that it says the benefits that are owed, and under the cases that have gone to trial so far under this issue, the Judge Kopelke found that the amount owed was more than the policy limits, but the amount owed would be the benefits owed of $1.1 million. I'll suggest
the statute says unreasonably delayed.
Unreasonably delayed.
Now, it may be that they didn't unreasonably delay full payment of the amount, because you have the whole theory of debatable number, a debatable claim, but it might be that the 250 that you talk about, their internal memo saying we ought to pay this amount, it was unreasonably withheld, so that it would have to be parsed out, it would seem to me.
And that perhaps would be an issue for the jury to decide what amount, and that's what the statute directs us, and with the new jury instructions direct us as well, is what amount was unreasonably delayed or denied. Mr. Kistelman has undergone five surgeries. At the time this occurred, he's had $260,000 in medical bills. He's had upwards of $700,000 now. He was making $120,000, $130,000, $140,000 a year. He's not working now. Significant damages in the face of a $28,500 computer-generated offer, a plethora, as the court has seen in the record, of request after request, please help me, please review my claim, and no review at all until seemingly the eve of trial, and as the court saw, let's offer $250,000 to make this case go away. And Judge Kopelke then finds more damages in excess of 1.3.
So let me ask you another question. So it's crystal clear that you're limiting your statutory claim to post-effective date.
How is the jury
supposed to figure out whether that was unreasonable or not without going back to other stuff that happened prior to the statute?
Your Honor, I would suggest that, again, there would be a limiting instruction in that regard. The plaintiffs have submitted their expert reports to state why it's unreasonable, and we have our arguments as to why it's unreasonable. In deference to the defense, they have stated their arguments as to why they believe it was reasonable. It is the same thing that bad faith juries wrestle with in the trenches on a day-to-day basis. The standard for this, though, is unreasonable conduct, and of course in the area of bad faith, it's a reckless disregard for the fact that it was unreasonable. But it would be the same factual issues that courts wrestle with, or juries wrestle with as well.
Did you also agree that if this division were to agree with you and send it back, that
it doesn't automatically mean
the trial court's first got to decide to send it summary judgment motion.
Yeah, sure. I would agree that the pending summary judgment motions are before the court.
That's not in front of us.
That's not in front of the court now. I would make my arguments as to why those would be denied, but I agree that the pending summary judgment motions are still standing before that court.
Theoretically, the court could find, as a matter of law, that the conduct of the insurance company was not unreasonable under the statute, if it had to.
Yes, but I believe that the court's holding in this case was as a matter of a legal holding, and we have submitted that there's facts that it's unreasonable, and we are arguing that it should apply prospectively.
That hasn't been, whether they're unreasonable has yet to be decided. That's the subject of the pending summary judgment motions.
The pending summary judgment motion deals with the issue of whether it's unreasonable, and I also believe my opposing counsel, it also deals with the bad faith issues of the reckless disregard issues as well. I will reserve the rest of my time, if I may. Prior to this, American Family had submitted the James River case, which was the 10th Circuit case, and I had pointed out to opposing counsel that the 10th Circuit case that they submitted does not address this 10-3-11-16 issue. The original opinion did, and then it was withdrawn a month later with regard to the 10-3-11-16. So this is the first court to address the issue of the prospective nature and when there's unreasonable conduct. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, thank you.
You've got about 3 minutes and 14 seconds for any rebuttal you want.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Suzanne Lambden, and my my attorney registration number is 15113. I represent American Family in this matter. This is a late payment statute. It's not a statute that deals with ongoing evaluation or adjustment or omissions. It's a payment statute. So the question is, was there a delay or denial of payment of benefits owed? There's no case in Colorado and no statute, no legal authority of any kind that requires payment of UM/UIM benefits before there is a determination of the amount owed by the fact finder. There's no legal authority that even requires payment of what is sometimes referred to as an undisputed amount before there is a determination of what that amount is by a fact finder. Here there was not agreement. The insurance policy has an arbitration provision in it when parties need to determine what the value of a case is because they have not agreed on the value of the case. The arbitration was demanded in January of 2008. The statute took effect in August of 2008, and arbitration took place in November of 2008. The appellant has never argued that there was a late payment of the actual arbitration award that was submitted. The question here is, and he's narrowed this because he's got this problem with the retrospective application of the statute, he has narrowed his appellate issue to a three-month window of time between the date that the statute was enacted and the date that the arbitration took place.
Well, as you really pointed to four or five.
Three or four, I can't remember, instances in that where
time frame.
But is
from our time up to the
itself, delay was unreasonable.
I believe so, because the Colorado Constitution doesn't allow retrospective application of the statute.
No, I'm talking about going forward. In other words, is he limited to stopping in October of 2008, or can he say there was delay after that?
Well, what he has pointed to in his briefing and what he pointed to in the underlying court, which were the what he calls the specific instances of additional occurrences or something like that. He mentioned them, this, and it's during this window of time. So he is only arguing, you know, these few additional what he calls occurrences that happened between the date the statute was passed and the date that the arbitration took place. Judge Richman, you look like you have a question.
I have a question about what you said before, but I'm not sure you've answered Judge Long's question, so let's let you get that resolved first.
I understand that that's what he's argued up till now. My question is, as a matter of law or as a matter of stipulation or what the trial court has already ruled, is he limited to those, or can he say there was further unreasonable delay from October 2008 through the time that the money was actually paid? That's all I'm asking.
And I guess I would submit that he hasn't argued that because once the arbitration took place, there was an order that came out, and by the time the appellate or the arbiter determined what that amount was, American Family paid it immediately. So.
If I can go back to what you said. You said the statute only applies to delay of payment.
Yes.
And you make it sound like the statute only applies if an arbitration award has already been entered, or a judgment has already been entered, or an amount has already been stipulated to, and when they don't pay that amount timely, that's when the statute kicks in. And I'm curious how you get to that interpretation of the statute. I know it says unreasonably delay or deny payment, but it doesn't stop there. It says payment of a claim for benefits owed. Are you reading? Are you ignoring the words "claim for benefits owed" by stopping with the word "payment"?
No, I think that the question is. I mean, there is a question with regard to at what point are benefits owed, and we actually cited a Division of Insurance regulation in our briefing that I think is instructive on that point. The Division of Insurance regulation sets forth that an insurance company has a 60-day period in which to, after they receive a complete claim, they have a 60-day period in which to evaluate and make an offer. And then it talks about things that within, you know, would occur that would not, you know, trigger that duty to make an offer, which includes a demand for arbitration, litigation, additional information, investigation that needs to be done. But what I'm saying is that uninsured motorist benefits are, I mean, it's not like a medical bill that gets sent and has to be paid. It's not a certain amount with regard to what's owed. It's like in a third party case where somebody is injured, those decisions are, I mean, you reach a settlement or there's a fact finder that makes a determination of what that value is.
It seems like you're saying that this statute has no application until the amount is quantified and set and an arbitrator has awarded or a jury has determined it, and only then, if there's delay, does the statute kick in. Is that what you're arguing?
I would argue that
that's what you want.
I would argue that that would be accurate.
But that's not what the trial court... That wasn't the basis for the trial court's ruling here.
It was not the basis of the trial court's ruling. The trial court didn't really address that issue because of the retroactivity issue and the retrospective issue. And I agree, obviously, with the trial court's determination that in this case, the additional things that happened, even in this window of time, it wasn't a new transaction. It was the same sort of thing that was going on from even before before the statute was passed. There were requests that the company evaluate, adjust, and pay the claim before the statute was enacted, and those simply continued after the legislation occurred.
Talk about that. Because certainly under the common law, I think you're correct. But don't we have a brand new statutory appears to be standard of liability? Under those circumstances, a whole new.
It is a whole new ballgame. And I think, I mean, basically, that's one of the reasons that this statute, I mean, the statute should be applied prospectively, and it should not be applied in a retroactive manner or to these other, you know, it creates an entirely new cause of action.
So, but if at all satisfied, look on this claim.
Well, I think we have to look at the actual test set forth by the Colorado Supreme Court regarding retrospective application of a statute.
Why? Why do you have to consider that? I'd agree. Why do you even get into it once you decide?
Well, because the prospective application of a statute applies only to transactions that occur afterwards, and I don't think you can. So the question is, are these transactions that occurred after the enactment of the statute, or is this the same thing that was going on before the statute was enacted? And it is the same. The only, you know, basically. This case is distinguishable from all of the cases cited by counsel. In, for example, in the Nelson case, he talks about, it's called, what is it? It's South Specialty Restaurants versus Nelson, where the court in 2010 explained the constitutional prohibition, the fact that there's a two-part test that must be met, whether there is an intent that the statute apply retroactively, and only then do you get to the second step of the analysis. But basically in Nelson, the difference in that case was that there was an actually, there was a something completely new and different that happened after that statute was enacted, and that basically was a request for a benefit award.
That's called the common law. Here you have a statute where the legislature,
arguably, applies to bring after all.
Well, okay.
And so if that's the case, why is there any retroactivity issue at all?
Basically, if you look at the analysis in the Nelson case, you have to look at whether Nelson applied the statute prospectively. But then they did the second part of the analysis, which looked at whether this was a procedural or remedial or substantive change in the law, since the claim had accrued beforehand and since there were things that had happened before the statute in that case was enacted. Judge Richman?
I think what you're arguing is that this is a continuing act.
Yes.
And since it's a continuing act, it can't be recognized as a new claim.
Exactly.
But let's take for hypothetically, let's assume that the recognition that Mr. Kisselman may have been owed a minimum of $250,000, I'm taking his characterization of that memo.
Okay.
That act occurred after August, whatever it is, August 5th of 2008. That act could be evidence of bad faith in the common law claim. But it doesn't. It's just more evidence piling on, and it relates back.
Right.
But as an act itself, it didn't constitute it didn't give rise to a cause of action until until this statute was passed. In other words, while you say it might be a continuation, it may be for purposes of the bad faith claim a continuation, but could it be that that act was in itself a gave rise to a cause of action until the statute was passed. And what I'm suggesting is there's nothing to continue here because the statute didn't exist until August of 2008. Once the statute exists, how can an act after that be considered to be continuing? It might be continuing for the good faith claim, but it can't be continuing for the statutory claim.
Well, and I guess I would respond to that. There were demands beforehand that said, pay this. You have an obligation to adjust and evaluate. And immediately when the statute started, went into effect, those same demands continued. You have an obligation to adjust and evaluate. If you look at the complaint and the amended complaint, they are identical. Before the statute was enacted.
But it isn't the plaintiff's demands that give rise to the act that's unreasonable. It's the insurance company's acts. And the act of the insurance company that they allege was unreasonable was the failure to pay $250, given their recognition maybe that that was the minimum he was owed. Is that act itself, if the jury finds it, that it's unreasonable? I'm not saying they will find that unreasonable. There may be perfectly good reasons why they didn't pay it at that point in time, because there was arbitration or whatever. But if the jury finds that unreasonable, why shouldn't that be a claim that arises under the statute that says after August 5th, any unreasonable delay of payment or unreasonable refusal to pay is a separate tort, I guess.
I have to say that it's the same sort of thing that happened before the statute was enacted. There was a request for payment of the prior offer, and there was a request for payment of the subsequent offer. It just so happens that the statute was enacted in the interim. So I would say that basically what the statute did was it affected the vested right, I suppose, if you would say that there was an obligation to pay it that didn't exist before. It affected the rights of the company to have the amount determined in arbitration, which, you know, I think if you get to the...
Why? Why did it affect... But he's arguing that...
Well, if the argument is that that amount was owed and should have been paid by the company, and the company should be penalized by double benefits and attorney fees because they didn't make the payment because the statute was suddenly enacted beforehand, there's a contract in place that allows that issue to be determined by arbitration, which was scheduled for November. And I think the ex post facto constitutional prohibition deals specifically with rights affected under contracts. So, thank you.
A little over.
Your Honor, I'm prepared to submit the matter to the court, and unless the court has any other questions, and to give back our time to the court at this
point. Actually, Ms. Lambden's point, last point there raises an interesting question. The case is set for arbitration, and the most you're going to get on August 4th, I take it, is the amount that you're seeking in arbitration. And then if the jury finds in your good faith claim that that payment was unreasonably delayed, you may get some additional damages. I'm not sure what they would be. But now along comes the statute, and it affects the insurance company's rights, because all of a sudden now they're looking at double the damages if they have unreasonably delayed payment. Does that affect their vested rights?
I don't believe there is a vested right when it's the same an obligation to promptly, fairly, and evaluate the claim before, and to promptly, fairly evaluate the claim after. And I believe that the Continental Title Company versus District Court case addressed that well. It says the statute's not rendered. Well, that was the retroactivity issue, which wasn't before us. But if it's the same, you have to act reasonably. You have to act in a reasonable fashion, promptly, fairly investigate and evaluate a claim. And when they get information, they didn't do it after August 5th, 2008. At least that's what we'd like to be able to argue to the jury, and they can argue otherwise.
But if they didn't fairly and reasonably evaluate the claim before August 5th, what were they facing in terms of liability?
If they failed to reasonably evaluate the claim before August 5th, 2008,
in the good faith claim,
in the arbitration, if the contract is submitted, then the amount that they would owe is $1.1 million. We would also, we would also have, because that's how much his insurance contract was for.
Right.
And then he would also have a claim, as he has brought, for bad faith benefits. And then this statute goes into effect, which clearly states that you have, this is in addition to the tortious claims that are brought.
So it's twice as much now. That's my point. I mean, is that a vested right? Was there a vested right to pay only bad faith damages, and now their vested right has been altered because now they're required to pay two times, I think the statute says, two times the amount of the claim, I mean, the amount of the award, plus attorney's fees. Did that affect their vested rights?
Their vested rights is, and I may not understand the question, but their vested rights or obligations is to act reasonably and to evaluate the claim. I'm looking at it as from their perspective to say, we're looking at this, should we look at this or ignore this, or just wait until the end, right before trial, and see if it'll go away. I don't think they have a vested right to act in bad faith and to act unreasonably and to do what they did to Mr. Kissman, at least from our perspective, what we'd like to be able to argue to the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gold.
Thank you,
arguments. This will stand submitted. Of course.